content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello there, and welcome to the Spring 2014 edition of Heard Any Good Books Lately? A program from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm George Douglas. This program is brought to you by the Friends of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, an organization of citizens, volunteers, and patrons, all interested in supporting the library and the services it provides. Now, the Friends Group was founded in 1989 and now has more than 300 members across North Carolina. If you'd like to join the Friends Group yourself, we'll have information on how to do that later in the program. But this program is all about books, with special emphasis on those available from the North Carolina Library for the Blind. Now, the library has more than 86,000 titles in its collection. Did you know that? It's true. Books and magazines are available in large print, braille, and talking books as well, both digital and cassette. The library has more than 11,000 patrons across the state. And if you're not a patron but are interested in becoming one, I'll have more information about that at the end of this program as well. This month, we'll take a look at some of the most popular books checked out during the months of February and March of 2014 at the North Carolina Library for the Blind. We're going to begin today with Sycamore Row. It's a very, very popular novel by John Grisham, a direct sequel to his first novel, A Time to Kill, and once again features Jake Briggins as the main character. This was released in October of 2013, still pretty new, still up on the top 50 list in most book summaries there. Jake Briggins returns to the courtroom in a dramatic showdown as Ford County again confronts its tortured history. Set in fictional Clanton, Mississippi, 3 years after the sensational events in the trial of Carl Lee Haley from A Time to Kill, an employee of Mr. Seth Hubbard is instructed to meet his boss at a location by a sycamore tree at 2 p.m. on a Sunday. Now, the employee finds Mr. Hubbard dead, hung from a tree, because his terminal lung cancer was too painful and he was ready to end it. Accompanied with the body are very specific funeral and burial instructions. In his office, we rejoin Jake Briggins, who has lost his secretary, home, and dog thanks to the KKK, who tried to intimidate him during the Haley trial. Briggins is currently tied up in litigation with the insurance company after his house was burned down and has little to no money to show from the Haley trial. He receives a letter from Seth Hubbard. Briggins opens the letter and reads that Mr. Hubbard has written a new holographic will that renounces one he wrote a year ago in which he had left money to his daughter and son, as well as their grandchildren. In his holographic will, Mr. Hubbard stipulates that his children will receive nothing from the will. 5% will be given to his church, while the other 5% will be left for his brother. The remaining 90% is to be given to his black housekeeper, Letitia or Letty Lang, and that the will must be filed following the funeral and not a moment sooner, so his children, who rarely visited him during his cancer, can put on a show, then be left without nothing. Mr. Hubbard notes that his children will contest it because they are greedy and that Mr. Briggins has to do whatever it takes to make sure the holographic will is the enforced will. He says he chose Jake because of the admirable work that Jake did at the Haley trial 3 years prior to that. After a hotly contested battle which yields many twists and turns, and the trial looks lost for Briggins and Lang, a sensational deposition given by Mr. Hubbard's brother, Ansel, explains why Mr. Hubbard left the money to his housekeeper and the significance of the sycamore tree which Hubbard hung himself on. It really is an exciting novel by John Grisham, and it's called Sycamore Row. It's available now from the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. Now let's take a look at a book by another popular author, David Baldacci. This one is called King and Maxwell. David Baldacci brings back Sean King and Michelle Maxwell, former Secret Service agents turned private investigators, featured in the hit TNT series King and Maxwell, in their most surprising personal and dangerous case ever. It seems at first like a simple tragic story. Tyler Wingo, a teenage boy, learns the awful news that his father, a soldier, was killed in action in Afghanistan. Then the extraordinary happens. Tyler receives a communication from his father after his supposed death. Tyler hires Sean and Michelle to solve the mystery surrounding his father. But their investigation quickly leads to deeper, more troubling questions. Could Tyler's father really still be alive? What was his true mission? Could Tyler be the next target? Sean and Michelle soon realize that they've stumbled onto something bigger and more treacherous than anyone could have imagined. And as their hunt for the truth leads them relentlessly to the highest levels of power and to uncovering the most clandestine of secrets, Sean and Michelle are determined to help and protect Tyler, though they may pay for it with their lives. The book is called King and Maxwell, and it was written by David Baldacci. Now we'll move on to the next book. This is called The Gods of Guilt, a Lincoln lawyer novel. It was written by another mystery writer who's very, very popular, Michael Connelly. And this is actually taken from a review by Joe Hartlob that was done in December of 2013. I have always enjoyed the Mickey Haller series in spite of itself. I'm not especially endeared to defense attorneys philosophically, so it's been a bit of a leap for me to cheer for one. Michael Connelly's talent is such that he bridges the chasm without sacrificing any of the realistic elements that go with the territory. Yes, I said realistic in describing a series about an attorney whose office is the back seat of a Lincoln. I've known attorneys who operated out of motorhomes and one gent who in the 1970s ran his personal injury practice out of his hat. True. Accordingly, Connelly's Lincoln lawyer isn't much of a stretch, a state of affairs to which Haller himself gives a wink and a nod near the beginning of The Gods of Guilt, when he notes that he has picked up a couple of imitators as the result of a hit movie about his practice. It's a rare moment of levity in a book full of dark moments. Things get rolling when Haller receives a text that connects him with a client accused of murder. Those cases are potentially Haller's most lucrative, and the client, Andre Lacasse, an internet pimp, actually has the ability to pay Haller's considerable retainer against his even more considerable hourly rate. Lacasse is accused of murdering a prostitute named Giselle Dallinger and robustly maintains his innocence. Haller has been there before, but this one is a bit different. First of all, Lacasse appears to be the victim of a frame-up, one that has far-reaching repercussions on both sides of the law. For another, the case has some painful and personal repercussions as well. Dallinger turns out to be a former client of Haller's, someone who he thought he had assisted in successfully rehabilitating and moving to Hawaii to begin a new life. As Haller's investigation follows the twists and turns of Dallinger's life, from when he represented her several years before, when she used the name Gloria Dayton, to her violent death in a La Brea apartment, Haller comes to the realization that he had been played both during and after his representation of the woman, and that his current representation of Lacasse may be putting him in the crosshairs of significant danger. As readers of the Lincoln Lawyer books well know, Haller is successful in part because of his brashness and boldness. Perhaps, however, he takes his tendencies in this regard a step too far, and tragic consequences result. that have a permanent effect upon him and his team. If anything, the loss makes him more determined than ever to see LaCasa's case through to the end. During the course of an electrifying trial, he experiences a series of twists and turns that break new ground for him and may well take the series in a different direction. Longtime fans of Connolly's work will be pleased to know that Harry Bosch makes a cameo appearance that highlights, however briefly, the similarities and differences between Haller and his formerly long-lost half-brother. There's also a mystery that remains unsolved at the close of the book that at some point down the literary road may give the siblings cause to pool their respective skill sets, if not join forces. However, The Gods of Guilt certainly stands tall on its own merits as one of Connolly's better books, full of twists and turns and one very unexpected incident that will reverberate in readers' thoughts long after the last page is read. That review by Joe Hartlaub in December of 2013. The book, again, it's called The Gods of Guilt, a Lincoln Lawyer novel, and it's by mystery writer Michael Connolly. And we'll have another good book to talk about in just a minute. But right now I want to take a little break to read to you an article that I think you might find interesting from the Tar Heel Talk, the winter edition 2013 and 2014 from the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. And the article is entitled Announcing Bard Mobile, Another Way to Download Books. People who are blind, visually impaired, or have a physical disability may now download audio and braille books to their iPhone, iPad, or iPod Touch if they are registered with the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped in the Library of Congress. And the Braille and Audio Reading Download, which is often referred to as BARD, B-A-R-D, mobile app, is now available through the Apple App Store. The app, which is free, allows readers to download audio and braille books from their NLS BARD accounts. Access to BARD is provided through local cooperating libraries. BARD contains nearly 50,000 books, magazines, and music scores, too, in audio and braille formats, with new selections added daily. NLS Director Karen Kenninger said the BARD mobile app allows searching, downloading, and reading braille and talking books and magazines on one fully accessible mainstream device. It's like a library in your pocket. She explained that with BARD Mobile, patrons can play talking books and magazines on their iOS devices. Patrons may also read electronic braille books, magazines, and music scores using a refreshable braille display connected to their iPhone, their iPad, or iPod Touch through Bluetooth. Now, patrons will be able to receive their reading materials faster, and they won't have to be weighted down with bulky volumes or playback equipment. NLS has provided free library service for people who have visual disabilities for more than 80 years, and for people with physical disabilities since 1966. Best known as the Talking Book Program, NLS upgraded its analog program to digital in 2009, and we talked about that back here on this program just within the last year or so. NLS is also working on an app for Android devices, by the way. The North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped will advise you about this process as we obtain information from NLS. Lots more to come about that, but just more and more interesting ways to have access to great books. And you can get more information anytime by calling the North Carolina Library for the Blind. We'll have that information for you right at the end of this program. Now let's get back to the books here. The next book we want to talk about is one that was very popular in the last couple of months. It's called Fear Nothing by Lisa Gardner. Recovering from a nasty fall down a flight of stairs, Detective D.D. Warren of Boston Homicide tangles with a pair of sisters who put her pain in a whole new perspective. 40 years ago, Harry Day, about to be arrested for killing 8 prostitutes, got his wife to slit his wrists before the police closed in. He left behind 2 young daughters, Shayna, a sociopath who followed so closely in her father's footsteps that she was jailed for life when she killed a neighborhood boy at age 14, and Adeline, not quite a year old when her father died, who's grown up cursed by an inability to feel physical pain. Naturally, Adeline went to medical school and became a psychiatrist specializing in pain management, and it's in that capacity that Dee Dee consults her after an accident at a blood-soaked crime scene leaves her with an impressive set of injuries. Christine Ryan, the victim who's been smothered and flayed by someone who left behind a bottle of champagne, a pair of fur-lined handcuffs, and a long-stem rose, is followed distressingly quickly by a second victim, occupational therapist Regina Barnes. Even worse, the handiwork of the Rose Killer, as he's called, is gruesomely linked to the criminal careers of Harry Day, dead these 40 years, and his daughter Shayna, who's been in the Massachusetts Correctional Institute for over 25 years. Alternating, as usual, between third-person chapters following Dee Dee's investigation and first-person chapters dramatizing Adeline's point of view, Gardner paints an indelible portrait of 2 troubled sisters so closely bound together by blood that they agree that blood is love. If you think Gardner pulled out all the stops in Dee Dee's previous cases, Catch Me in 2012, you ain't seen nothing yet. Better fasten your seatbelt for this roller coaster ride through family hell. It sounds like quite a book. And that one is called Fear Nothing by Lisa Gardner. And now on Heard Any Good Books Lately, we'll turn to another author who is consistently, very consistently, in the top 50 most popular books in the United States and, I believe, around the world as well. He's also one of the most popular writers for books going out of the North Carolina Library for the Blind. His name is James Patterson, of course, and the book we're going to talk about now is called Cross My Heart. And once again, we'll turn to a review by Joe Hartlob that was written this past November. The publication of Cross My Heart marks 21 volumes in 20 years in the Alex Cross canon. James Patterson's career trajectory has risen and widened remarkably, phenomenally, in fact, in the ensuing 2 decades since Alex Cross was introduced in Along Came a Spider. While Patterson, both before and after Cross's conception, has created many popular characters, his most enduring certainly has been Cross. This, in no small part, has been due to the continuing changes in Cross's professional and personal lives, which have taken place across the length of the series. Cross is now a psychologist in private practice who frequently consults with the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department, attempting to balance the rigors and demands of this work with his considerable duties as a husband and father, and grandchild as well, to his family. It is those familial duties that provide the underlying propellant for Cross My Heart, and which Cross is under significant pressure to solve 2 cases. The first involves a series of attacks carried out in massage parlors in the Washington, D.C. area. Now, someone is entering the establishments and killing employees and customers at will. When one of the victims is discovered to be a very popular professional football player, the Metro D.C. police come under public and private pressure to solve the killings and bring the perpetrator to justice. This particular murder becomes a symbol of D.C.'s skyrocketing crime rate, and each day that goes by without the arrest of a suspect is like a stroke tally of failure for the department. Well, even more frustrating for Cross is the other case, which concerns the kidnapping of infants by a seemingly brazen woman who convinces parents and caregivers to literally surrender control of their offspring to her. Cross feels a deep personal responsibility to solve and stop the kidnappings, and when he makes a startling discovery that links the abductions to other offenses, a pattern begins to emerge. His investigation, though, comes at a price: time with his family. While each member is in need of his presence and wise counsel for various reasons, not the least of which is a long-planned and extensive home remodeling project that has Cross's grandmother, the woman who raised him, at her wit's end. While all of those elements are in play, events of great significance, of which Cross is not immediately aware, are about to change his life forever. A brilliant criminologist who is also a dangerous killer is obsessed with committing perfect crimes, and he is determined to take down and destroy Cross for good. With almost inhuman patience, Marcus Sunday, known as the Writer, is observing Cross and his family, learning their patterns, interests, and everything else about them that can possibly be acquired through observation and surveillance. Sunday, with the aid of an equally deranged and seductive accomplice, waits for just the right moment and then strikes, systematically taking Cross's life apart in one fell swoop, leaving him with nothing and almost no one. By the end of the book, Cross's life is forever changed. Patterson has never shied away from making dramatic changes in Cross's life, and for his 20th anniversary book, he pulls out all the stops, even more so than usual. In an author's note at the conclusion of Cross My Heart, he assures us that Cross, at least, will be back in another volume. Who else will make the cut, literally? We will have to wait until next year to find out. Be rest assured, though, that the results will be anything but predictable. It sounds like a real page-turner. That is Cross My Heart by James Patterson. Now let's take a look at another exciting mystery story. This is another Jack Reacher novel by Lee Child. It's called Never Go Back, and I'm reading here from a review by Janet Maslin that was published in late summer just last year. Lee Child's bodacious action hero, Jack Reacher, has already tramped through 17 novels and 3 ebook singles, but his latest, Never Go Back, may be the best desert island reading in the series. It's exceptionally well plotted and full of wild surprises, and wise about Reacher's peculiar nature, too. Positively Bunyan-esque in its admiring contributions to Reacher lore. We knew this guy was big, smart, and tough, but Never Go Back offers this description: an extreme mesomorph physique with a six-pack like a cobbled city street and a chest like a suit of NFL armor and biceps like basketballs and subcutaneous fat like a Kleenex tissue. What a description. Reacher achieves this look with zero gym time and a pie and cheeseburger diet. He does get exercise, but it comes from episodes that end with some version of, "So I bang their heads against the side of their car." This book's most memorable martial arts display has Reacher keeping his promise to demolish two other guys with his hands behind his back. "I'd put a bag on my head if I had one," he volunteers. Reacher starts this particular fight with an impressive kickoff. Mr. Child begins Never Go Back with some swift kicks, too. For the last couple of Reacher adventures, the author has been teasing readers with the thought that someday Reacher might return to the northeastern Virginia headquarters of the elite military police unit that he once ran. The reason for his return? the telephone voice of Major Susan Turner, the woman now in Reacher's old job. Their flirtation began in the book 61 Hours when he was in South Dakota, but that was 4 books ago, and Reacher is a guy who has made detours a way of life. As the new book begins, he has gone back to his old office and quickly gotten himself incarcerated. First of all, he faces a homicide charge. Second, there's a paternity suit. And third, Major Turner is not at her desk. And fourth, Reacher didn't read the fine print when he left the military in 1997. His status became that of a reservist. Now, he's ordered back into the army. Mr. Child's earlier titles have included Bad Luck and Trouble, The Hard Way, and A Wanted Man. So Jack Reacher is no stranger to sudden misfortune, but he remembers nothing about the man he supposedly killed or the woman whose child he supposedly fathered. He realizes pretty quickly, though, that these are trumped-up charges. He also realizes that Major Turner is in trouble, and Mr. Child orchestrates a fine sequence that places the two of them in adjacent jail cells, though they still haven't met. What he does with the sounds of cell doors closing, the prisoner's problem of having no shoelaces, and Reacher's eagerness to get a look at this woman is terrifically ingenious, and the two haven't even joined forces yet. But then they escape together, and this gives each of them ample opportunity to admire the other's military acumen. Turner, as she is mostly called, is a kindred spirit to Reacher, and she gets him to think about what kind of man he is. When he opens up enough to describe his wanderlust and a sight of primal urge for wild creatures to spread their DNA, Turner isn't surprised. She does tell him to shut up about that when he deals with the paternity suit awaiting him in California. Mr. Childs creates a breathless cross-country spree for his runaways, and as usual, he treats a journey as a series of problems that are there to be solved. It sounds like a good one as well. It's called Never Go Back, a Jack Reacher novel by the popular author Lee Child, and that was a review by Janet Maslin from August of 2013. And we have time for one more quick one here. The Third Deadly Sin by Lawrence Sanders. Retired cop Edward Delaney takes on a female serial killer in this spine-tingling masterwork of suspense by Lawrence Sanders. By day, she's a middle-aged secretary no one would look at twice. But by night, dressed in a midnight black wig, a skin-tight dress, and spike heels, she's hard to miss. Inside her leather shoulder bag are keys, cash, mace, and a Swiss Army knife. She prowls smoky hotel bars for prey. The first victim, a convention guest at an upscale Manhattan hotel, is found with multiple stab wounds to his neck and genitals. By the time retired police detective Chief Edward Delaney hears about the case from an old colleague, the hotel ripper has already struck twice. Unable to resist the puzzle, Delaney follows the clues and soon realizes he's looking for a woman. As the grisly slayings continue, seizing the city in a chokehold of panic, Delaney must stop the mad woman before she kills again. The Third Deadly Sin by Lawrence Sanders. And that's all for this spring edition of Heard Any Good Books Lately? I'm George Douglas. I hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like more information about how to become a patron of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, simply Google or search for North Carolina Library for the Blind or call toll-free 1-888-388-2460. You can also use the same numbers and website to join the Friends of the North Carolina Library for the Blind, that wonderful organization that sponsors this monthly program on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for print and visually impaired audience. Heard Any Good Books Lately? Will be available right after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.